When does a phenomenon become the unknown? When all attempts at understanding fail, and those who thirst for knowledge and understanding watch as research turns to ash in their mouth. As the phenomenon turns from a riddle to be solved into anomalous fascination. Hello, friends. Thank you for tuning in to episode 3 of the Anomalous Fascination Podcast. We've covered some interesting things so far, the mysteries of space, the mysteries of life. But this week, I'd like to try something a bit different. This week, we'll be discussing the mysteries of the afterlife. Imagine being a father or mother for the first time. I'm sure for many of you, that isn't hard to imagine. Imagine the amount of joy and love in your heart watching a child take their first steps, say their first words, and even helping them through getting their head bonked for the first time. Imagine it's just an average day as you sit with your almost 2-year-old son, who seems to have learned to talk quite well before the age of 2. When suddenly, out of nowhere, the boy turns to you and says, "When I was your age, I changed your diaper." Now, I'm sure you'd shrug it off as a strange comment or even maybe a misunderstanding, and who could blame you? But then months continued to pass and your son kept making more and more strange comments, all of which seemed to point to the child implying he was your father. Now, I'm sure you'd play along and eventually say something like, "Well then, Dad, how exactly did you get here?" To which the child would reply, "I just went whoosh and came out of the portal." A bit off-put, but still amused, you would probably continue and say something like, "Wow, that's great. And tell me, did you have any siblings?" At which point the child would reply, "I had a sister. She turned into a fish. Some bad guys did it. She died." Silence fills the room as you sit stunned, because you know your father's sister was found dead, floating in the San Francisco Bay over 60 years ago, and you never told that to anyone. Now, being a bit unnerved but still curious, you might ask one last question. Do you know how you died? As suddenly your child, without saying a word, jerks back suddenly, clutching the top of his head as if he was in horrible pain. Which would seem like silly games to most observers. But you know different. Because your father died 3 years ago from a massive brain hemorrhage. I don't think I need to tell you that this what if actually happened, which begs the question of, how is that possible? Well, good news. That is precisely what we're going to discuss today. Let's take a stroll, shall we? In 1957, Dr. Ian Stevenson was appointed as the head of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Virginia. Stevenson had spent years prior working in various hospitals, researching biochemistry, and eventually psychoanalysis. Stevenson spent much of his early career in the 1940s in biochemistry before becoming disenfranchised with how reductive the field was. He wanted to explore the whole person. I mean, yes, there is the brain, but what about the mind? He soon became fascinated with the question early on of, why is it that human bodies can react so differently to stress? Why does one react with asthma and another with high blood pressure, when there is no logical reason fulfilled by either nature or nurture, meaning that it is not learned, nor is it hereditary. It just is. This was his earliest foray into researching questions that others were not asking. Eventually, the question evolved into, why is it that neither environment or heredity can account for certain fears, illnesses, or special abilities. This would become the core question of his research that eventually seemed to evolve and grow over time. He sought to explore that, in addition to heredity and environment, nurture versus nature, that perhaps a third factor could determine these things. Some type of personality or memory transfer, involving a process by which a personality survives death and is transferred to another body. Now, before you go running for the door or shut down and declare this all pseudoscience, let's first talk about Dr. Stevenson's personal background and his research. Dr. Stevenson was not a religious man, nor did he like using words like reincarnation. He hated it, in fact, and would try to describe his research in almost any other way. Stevenson, after taking over as the head of the Department of Psychiatry at UVA, wrote many essays and papers discussing his theories, one of which won an award and, most importantly, caught the eyes of some wealthy people who saw brilliance in his work. This particular essay was concerning 44 published cases of children who claimed to remember past lives. As a result of this attention, he received his first grant to travel to India to interview a child who was claiming to have past life memories. Once there, Dr. Stevenson found 25 more cases in just 4 weeks, which he investigated as well. This allowed him to write his first book, 20 Cases Suggestive of Reincarnation. Obviously, he noted that not all of these claims were legitimate, hence the math not adding up. Then the biggest contributing factor to Stevenson's work was Chester Carlson, who funded his works and, when he passed in 1968, left $1 million to the University of Virginia, with a caveat. It could only be used in the continued research of Dr. Stevenson. This allowed Stevenson to step down as the head of psychiatry and start a new branch in the psychiatry department. In fact, the only one of its kind at the time. The Division of Personality Studies, which would later be renamed the Division of Perceptual Studies. Stevenson began traveling everywhere, with mileage for this work estimated around 55,000 miles a year. This would result in Stevenson eventually producing around 3,000 case studies based on his personal interviews with children all across the globe. But what did his research look like? Well, he would interview the children, and often witnesses such as parents or other people who witnessed the child doing or saying something unexplainable. He would begin with the numerous subtle questions to both the children and witnesses to detect any possibility of fraud, including questions during the interview meant to confirm continuity between their story. After the interviews were completed, Stevenson would then search tirelessly for an alternative explanation for the testimony. If, for example, they claimed the personality inside of the child to be someone distant from them with no relation, was there any possibility of relationship between the family of that child and the family of the deceased? Or, generally speaking, for all of them, is there anywhere the child or family could have been that would explain the child producing this information? Or perhaps, more importantly, is the correlation a coincidence or maybe even just a result of a misunderstanding? Obviously, amongst the 3,000 cases, many were proven to either be frauds or there was an alternative explanation. And Stevenson always made sure to document this in his findings. Whether it be that there was the slightest association between the families, that the child was at a museum that featured the individual in question, or even smaller things such as information that did not pertain to the individual in question, that though much of the information was consistent, some of it was not. He was not seeking to confirm his own bias, he was simply trying to answer a question, whether affirmative or negative. But the fact was that the majority of these cases had absolutely no alternative explanation. During his studies, he began to find some even more compelling aspects that go even beyond just the human mind. He began to discover that children who claim memories of past lives had unexplainable accompanying physical alterations as well. Some children were born with physical defects such as a missing finger or unexplainable scar on their head. Others, more frequently, would be born with unusual birthmarks, oftentimes on the forehead or at the bottom of the jaw, with another larger one on the top of their head. This was possibly the most haunting part of this subject matter, which was that almost every time, without fail, the birthmarks would fit the exact locations of bullet wounds that killed the deceased that allegedly inhabited their mind. Pretty spooky stuff, huh? And of course, the various birth defects would be identical to a physical characteristic of the deceased. He also had known about the study of xenoglossy, which is the paranormal phenomena in which a person can speak or write a language they could not have acquired by normal means, which has been around since the Bible. However, he did not do so much research in xenoglossy as, after investigating two cases of it, he discovered he did not have the proper understanding of language research to pursue this any further. The fact was that Dr. Stevenson was doing a job that almost no one in the scientific community wanted. To research something that would receive more scrutiny and mockery than almost any other subject matter researched. But the question is this. If his research resulted in even the tiniest sliver of evidence that human consciousness does not end in death, what research could possibly be more important than that? Think about it. Stevenson's career spanned from the mid-40s to the early 2000s, before his death in 2007, during which time he was berated, judged, mocked, and put down in paper after paper by other researchers. But he had tough skin. If the criticism was purely out of disbelief, he would simply take it and move on. If the criticism was regarding his research methods, he would always provide a rebuttal that would concisely explain the inaccuracies of their statements or explain any details they may have misunderstood. But the fact was, very few in the research community disputed his research methods. In fact, most of the scientific community would say things along the lines of, "His research methods are extraordinarily thorough, detailed, and well-designed. It's just too bad he's chosen to waste his talent on such rubbish." Nonetheless, the scientific community would sit there acting like a child watching their mom prepare dinner, complaining nonstop, and when asked, "Then why don't you help? We can get it done much faster with more of us," they quickly walk away, off to write another scathing review. In a 2012 article by researcher Jesse Baring, he discussed this very thing, why scientists refuse to acknowledge his work, saying, and I quote, "I'd be happy to say it's all complete and utter nonsense, a moldering cesspool of irredeemable anti-scientific drivel. The trouble is, it's not entirely apparent to me that it is." So why aren't scientists taking Stevenson's data more seriously? The data doesn't fit our working model of materialistic brain science, sure. But does our refusal to even look at his findings, let alone to debate them, come down to our fear of being wrong? "The wish to not believe," Stevenson once said, "can influence as strongly as the wish to believe," end quote. There are numerous incredible cases that Stevenson researched, many of which are easily available to be found online. Seriously, give it a quick Google. Some of the stories are amazing. I simply cannot begin to go through all of them in the short time we have together, but the fact remains that based on Stevenson's studies for decades and the continuation of his work by his protege, Dr. Jim Tucker, who took over his position at UVA in 2002, there's still no alternative explanation for thousands of cases, and more data points towards, rather than away, from the idea of the mind being able to persist through death. Dr. Tucker's continued work using Stevenson's methods is beginning to grow, as he is using computer programs to compile data from all of the children interviewed over decades, and of course adding many more as he continues the interviewing process himself. This computer program is being used to find similarities, constants, or irregularities. Thus far, he's discovered, amongst other things, that 70% of cases involve a deceased that died of a traumatic death, and that the average time between death and apparent rebirth is an average of 16 months. His work continues as he brings more and more of these stories into the forefront for everyone to see, and most importantly, for the families that are scared, confused, or shook to their very core, he serves as a continuing resource to help put their minds at ease, as he has a page online, easily discoverable, that explains what may be happening, things to listen or look for, and contact information to speak with Dr. Tucker himself. So the question then becomes, if we could potentially know the what of the situation, what is the how of the situation? Stick around after this short break to learn more. So, is there anything that can explain how the mind could persist through death? Well, there simply hasn't been enough studies done by scientists who are qualified to look into such things. Dr. Stevenson and Tucker simply are not qualified to look into these questions. However, Tucker and others have offered some possibilities. Both Tucker and Max Planck, the father of quantum mechanics, see merit in the possibility of consciousness, the non-physical, entering the physical realm. I would love to go deeper in with you regarding subatomic particles and quantum mechanics, but let's face it, nobody wants that. Especially me. Additionally, in a book written by astrophysicist Carl Sagan, he states that the phenomena of children reporting details of a previous life, which upon checking turns out to be accurate and which they could not have known about in any other way other than reincarnation, is an area of parapsychological research deserving of serious study. Lastly, the first law of thermodynamics, or the law of conservation of energy. This is a frequently cited source for various spirit-based phenomena, which cites that energy can neither be created nor destroyed. So, where does the energy go when a person dies? And could it be that a piece of our consciousness goes with it? Perhaps time will tell, but for now, we sit and wonder, and for those of you who hear this story and are inspired, there is always time for a career change or a new major, as a division of perceptual studies does still exist at the University of Virginia. So what did we learn? Did we confirm our own biases? Change our minds? Or did we simply observe a story about two men who respected science so much that they opened their mind to something that they themselves didn't believe in, and in doing so gave it the research and dedication that it so badly deserved? I hope so, because I find that wonderful. Thanks again for listening to Episode 3 of the Anomalous Fascination Podcast. Please be sure and subscribe to this show on the podcast app of your choice so you never miss an episode. And be sure to check the show out on Twitter, @AnomalyPod, or email me at anomalousfascination@gmail.com. And as always, thanks for listening.